Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything. Feel it coming. Till you wake up on your own.
So I'm at the Marine South Expo at Camp Lejeune almost 2 weeks ago. And I get there, and the guy who runs it, Alex Hetherington, says, "Hey, come here, I want you to meet somebody." I said, "Okay. Who is it?" And he takes me by the elbow, he takes me, to meet the guy who's on the phone right now, John Legato. So, John, I'm getting some feedback. I don't know what that is. If I'm on speaker or something, but
yeah, let me take you off.
Okay.
This should be an adventure.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
John's an old talk radio guy, so he knows the adventure of audio world. So.
Oh, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. You all right? You ready?
Is that any better?
A little bit. I can still hear something in the background.
All right, stand by. I'm gonna fix it if I get cut off.
No. You take your time. We got time.
All right, that should do it.
That did do it.
Yeah.
All right. So, John, before we talk about the book that you've written and Sergeant Major Canley and Alpha 1-1, I want to talk about you, if you don't mind. Talk to us. Born and raised where?
South Philadelphia.
Now, you and I were just talking off the air. Did you know Tony Zinni growing up?
No, I didn't. We're probably in two different parts. I don't know how old Tony is. I'm 72, so he might be a year or two younger, but his best friend was a friend of mine in the FBI. His best friend and best man at his wedding is an FBI agent I knew in New York. So it's a small Marine Corps, small FBI.
Well, yeah, and there's a – I don't know this for a fact, but I've heard it notionally. The FBI is an advanced staging area for Marines, yes?
Used to be, yeah. I would imagine it back in the 70s and 80s. It was maybe 15-20% of all agents were former Marines. And it was the easiest transition to make from the military as law enforcement. So we had a bunch of Marines.
All right. So, John, talk to us. So you've grown up in South Philadelphia. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Well, I went to college in 1965. I was the first person in my large Italian family to get accepted to college in 1965. And in 1966, I was the first person in my large Italian family to get expelled from college. So, for those that remember, there was no lottery back then, and you were, if you didn't have, the only two exemptions were education or health reasons, you know, and I, unfortunately, I was in great health, and guys were getting drafted 30, 40 days into the Army back in late 66, early 67. So, not wanting to go into the Army, I outsmarted. I didn't want to go to Vietnam, and back then they had waiting lists up to a year for the Navy and Air Force. So I outsmarted everybody by joining the Marines, and after a few shots of Seagram 7 at the Triangle Bar in South Philly. So and they could do that back then. I think they promised me I was going to be a jet pilot, the recruiter.
Oh, really? So this was going to be a way of avoiding Vietnam?
This is what?
Did you say this is going to be a way of avoiding Vietnam?
A way of the what?
A way of avoiding Vietnam. Is
yeah,
that...
No. What happened, the whole story is I went in and I told the recruiter that I didn't want to go to Vietnam and I didn't want to be a grunt. And he said, no problem, I'll sign here. And I did. And when I went, and the other thing he told me, I'd never been on an airplane. He said, if you sign, we'll fly you down to Parris Island. So I report in, there was about 7 guys, and he said, take these guys to the train station. And I said, there must be a mistake, sir. I'm flying. The recruiter laughed. And I was infantry. I was 0311. We had 66 Marines that graduated boot camp. And back then, they read your orders the night before you graduated. And something like 66 or something received orders for West Vietnam. So we're all going to Vietnam.
Well, congratulations. You navigated that well. So your life's off to a great, but you didn't know anybody in the Marine Corps. Nobody in your family had influenced you in terms of heading that direction. This idea is your idea.
Yeah, my family, all World War II Army. And, I don't know. You know, I've thought about why, and I really think it's because I had one more Seagram 7 shot than I should have. And on Broad Street in Philadelphia, for those people who know, it's, the main drag in Philadelphia, and they had recruiters. And I said, well, I don't want to go to Vietnam. I'll go, So I stopped at the Air Force. Forget that. I then had a year waiting list. The Navy had about 8 months. And I didn't like the Army. I don't know why. I just, so.
There you have it. I'm going to join the Marine Corps, so I'm not going to get sent to Vietnam. So you join the Marine Corps, and so you do recruit training, and do you go straight to Vietnam?
Yeah. Let me dispel another myth, I have totally flat feet. And so the next day I woke up, and I joined the Marines, and people are saying, I don't want to join the Marines. I said, well, your feet are totally flat. They won't take you when you go for your physical. And the only body part they looked at is, as you know, you bend over and spread your cheeks. They looked at my butt, never looked at my flat feet. So if anybody has flat feet and think they can get exempted now, although we don't have a draft, forget about that one.
He's good. Next. What just happened? Congratulations, son. So talk to us about the process as a whole of going to Vietnam. When did you go? Because Vietnam is it's going at that point. I mean, we're past the stage that we have, a few units there fighting the Viet Cong in the coastal plains. We're a little bit beyond that. And what month did you get sent to Vietnam?
In August, it was either late July, early August of 67, and back then it didn't take long. In my boot camp, we had about 8 guys that had the choice, jail or the Marines, and the guy in the rack below me came to boot camp with a knife wound in his back. He still had the bandage. The recruiters would literally wait in courthouses, and the judge knew they'd be there. And if the judge determined that somebody needed a break, they would say to them, I'm going to sentence you to 6 months in jail, or you can join the Marines. And if they joined the Marines, the recruiter just, the judge just pointed to the recruiter. They signed up. Everything was quick. The physical was quick. You got your orders. They needed bodies back in 67, 68. So you were on the fast track to Vietnam.
All right, so you get there, and what is Alpha Company 1-1 doing when you arrive? Where are they?
They're in Quang Tri. And remember, Vietnam was the only replacement war in our history. So we didn't train as a unit, deploy as a unit, and come back. So you're an individual. I landed in Da Nang. They said, get on that truck. And there was a bunch of Marines on the truck. And as we were driving north from Da Nang, the truck would stop and would say, you're going in whatever unit. And I'm the last one on the truck. I had no idea I was going north. And we went up to Quantri, and that's where 1-1 was. Their base was in Quantri province.
All right. And one of the things I've found that's so interesting about Vietnam is that the experience for guys who fought there was so different based on where they were, what year they were there, and who they were fighting. So you show up, and 1-1 is in Quang Tri, and what are they doing? Are they fighting mostly VC in the coastal plain? Talk to us about what you guys were doing when you got there.
Well, Quang Tri, yeah, I mean, we were fighting VC, and, I mean, there were firefights, night ambushes, we'd go on operations. But it was just, and we got some firefights there. That here, couple months, that was our base that we operated patrols out of. And then in November, I think, of 67, we got orders to go to Con Tien, which was right on the DMZ.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah, talk about that. I mean, I will tell you what. I mean, for those that have never read about the battles in the around up at the DMZ, that's where you hear the legend of the Walking Dead. First Battalion, 9th Marines. You hear the some of the movement, the contacts that were conducted into the DMZ, and just the bloody fighting that went on up there. And around Con Tien, just if you've never read it, it's just jaw-dropping in terms of the ferocity of what went on there with an enemy that would close with you. What was that like, John? You're going out and patrolling and you're ambushing, and all of a sudden you're in a main force war up in the vicinity of Con Tien.
Well, yeah, it was right on the DMZ, and then what happened is they had a lot of artillery, mortars, rockets. They would roll the artillery out in North Vietnam and just shell us. We were hitting Con Tien with between 300 and 400 rounds of rockets, mortars, and artillery a day. And we didn't have traditional shelter halves up there. We were dug under the mud. It was just a mud hole. Con Tien was basically three little hills that could only hold one battalion. So it was a monthly rotation. And the problem was there were three or four NBA battalions surrounding Con Tien. So we ran a few patrols outside and took so many casualties. I mean, it was like trench warfare. There was just trenches up there, and the NBA was up close and personal. That's the first time that you saw the enemy you were fighting. One time we got hit, and some of the Marines and were describing the enemy as no more than 15, 20 meters away. Just an amazing up-close battle for the first time, unlike fighting in the South.
Amazing. No, I would recommend everybody, if you're looking to read some amazing stuff, those fights that went on up there were amazing. So the early spring comes, the Tet New Year comes, and you guys go to Hue. Now, I don't want to talk about Hue so much, because we'll come back to that. Let's talk about after Hue. So after Hue City, you still have half of your deployment gone, and you've been to Quang Tri, you've been to Con Tien and Hue City. What happens? Where do you go after Hue City?
About 6 months in the hospital in the Philippines. I've been hit three times at Hue, and so sound, but everybody was hit at Hue. I mean, we have to go back to Hue, and talk about the original 147 Marines that went in on the first day from Alpha Company, which was the initial reaction force. I got hit on the 6th and the 21st, and they medevaced me. I had sepsis. My wounds were festering. And, they put me on a helicopter. But, you know, it sounds, every Marine way, there was, I think, 504 Purple Hearts issued in a few days. It could have been 2,000 because everybody had, guys were using their M16 as a cane, bullet holes, you know, burnt, you know, busted eardrums, shrapnel, broken bones, and everybody was refusing medevacs. Or, you know, of course, we couldn't get any medevacs in the first couple of days anyway. But so it was a interesting, different type of battle, more World War II than Vietnam.
The so where are your wounds, John? You're it's 6 months in the hospital. That's a long time. Where were your wounds?
I had shrapnel in the hands and shoulder, ankle, back, and I got greased in the head with a bullet, which, believe it or not, was not my worst wound. It was a clean cut or, you know, crease.
Right. Wow.
But
wow.
My problem was, you know, from the 1st to the 12th on going in, and then the 21st, and the conditions were not sanitary. So my wounds, and everybody was wounded, so it's not like they could take care of me.
Right.
Just got infected, and on the 21st, I tried to refuse again, and Lieutenant General Smith said, "You're out of here." That second lieutenant then.
All right, I want to talk about your career, and then I want to come back to Way, and then your writing of the book. So you spend the next 6 months in the Philippines, and then are you done when you get out of the hospital in the Philippines? Do you then go home, or do you go back to Vietnam? Walk us through that.
No, I'm done. Back then too, three Purple Hearts, you had to sign a waiver. There was some kind of congressional something that. If you had three Purple Hearts, you're out of the war zone. I volunteered to go back, and they wouldn't let me. You know, there's a lot of survivor guilt. I mean, my friends were still back there, and I volunteered. They said no. So I got out in June of 69, and I went back to college. I was in college when they asked me to leave and get my bachelor's and then my master's. And for about 8 of those years, I worked with severely handicapped children and adults, developmentally disabled, which was a great time, rewarding time working with severely handicapped children.
Well, and, John, what did you get your degree in?
Well, my undergraduate was history, and my master's was in psychology, and then I started my doctorate at the University of Pittsburgh in clinical psychology, and then I had a appointment to the FBI, so I discontinued the doctorate and went and became a special agent.
Wow! So when you got your doctorate in psychology, what was your intention?
Well, I didn't get it. I left before I got my doctorate.
But did you
was to teach?
Was to teach. Okay. All right. How does the FBI get on your radar?
Well, I had. The problem is I was working with handicapped children, and I kept getting promoted. And eventually I became the deputy commissioner for the state, and I never left the office. And I realized that even in the Marine Corps or the FBI, I craved the field. I loved being in the field. Like, I loved being with the people I was working with. So I'm sitting in an office, and I said, So I applied to the FBI, the CIA, and Naval Intelligence, and that process takes a year of tests and interviews. And basically, at the end of a year, over a three-month period, I had three offers, the FBI, CIA, and Naval Intelligence. And long story short, my wife said, "You're going in the FBI." So that's what I did.
You go in the FBI, and then I was reading your bio, so, and then very famously, how do you go into the the undercover business. What prepares you for that, or how do you become a candidate? Could you explain that to us?
Well, when I went, it was different than it is now. They have all kinds of safeguards and psychological testing. But basically, when I went undercover, I'm like Italian from South Philly.
Right.
And they took one look at me and said, do you want to go undercover? It's voluntary. And I said, be out of the office. They said, yeah, I said, sign me up. And my first partner was Donnie Brasco. I don't know if you saw the movie with Johnny Depp. But
you
that
bet.
Was,
you bet.
He was my mentor, still is, talked to him all the time. And Joe is, you know, the one that trained me for undercover. They didn't have a formalized training program, certification program, but now they do. So I got trained by the best.
So you do that, and then do you retire out of the FBI, and then you have a very, very interesting career. You at some point you get into the talk radio business. So walk us through the end of your career in the FBI, and then the other things that you've done.
Well, I started out I had a 2-year stint deep cover. Now the difference between deep cover, a lot of cops and agents go undercover. They go in the office, they go out and make a controlled buy of narcotics, and they go back in the office. And that's short-term cover. I was in deep cover where you never go near the office. You have an assumed name. You have a different location. And I did that for 8 years. I did a two-year stint, and then a 4-year stint. And when I wasn't undercover deep, I was a pilot. The FBI has an aviation program, and it's off-site. So it's basically a covert program where we have an airplane, and our cover is whatever the cover is, either, you know, photography or, you know, surveying or whatever. So I did that for 5 years. I flew missions. And then towards the end of my career, since I was undercover so much, they sent me overseas to do diplomatic training missions. I was in Russia 3 times, got to meet Putin, Budapest, Dubai, Estonia. I spent a lot of time in London working with Scotland Yard and training. I can't even remember all the places. And then I retired.
So how do you get now? How does that guy become your next? You know, you become a writer and a talk radio host. How does that all come about?
And yeah, the talk show radio host was great. It was Salem Communications, which is, right, as you know, big.
Yeah, they're big, huge.
They had a show that they were doing, and they asked me if I would come in and just be a resource person on crime, you know, federal government, statutes, law enforcement stuff. And the sponsor was the Ohio Patrolman's Benevolent Association, and the director was supposed to be one half of the team to do interviews and stuff. And the other half was this professional, Dave Milo, who's got a big name in Cleveland, Ohio. He was at ESPN, and he's got the deep voice, and he was the professional, and they were teaming him up with this other guy. So we go in the first day, and they hand him, you know, the headset. They're showing him around the studio, and he looks at me and says, I can't do this. And he gave me the earphones, and I did that for like 10 years. We had a wonderful show in Cleveland. We had, you know, guests like Don King, Chris Hansen from Dateline, some, you know, cabinet level officers, mob guys in the witness protection program calling in. It was a great show.
Wow. So then at what point how does the writing thing begin? Is it just a natural outcropping of you've done some pretty interesting things in your life? Maybe I should write these things down. Talk to us about how does that happen?
The writing thing is tough. Everybody wants to write a book, and that's a very tough thing to break. What happened, I was in New York with the FBI, and I met some mystery writers, some really you know, big names, Mary Higgins Clark or Clark Higgins. And they would meet once a month at different bars in Manhattan. They're mystery writers, and they would discuss books, either that's coming out or ideas for books. And I met a woman named Lucy Freeman, who is an author. And she said, why don't you just come and, you know, we'll pick your brain. And then after a few months, they said, you should write a book. So I did. And the first book I write is published by St. Martin's Press, which is probably one of the biggest publishing houses in the world. And then there was a 20-year delay between my first and second book.
All right, so let's now I want to go back to Hui, and then I want to go from Hui into the book. When do you first cross paths as a young PFC? And as you said, I heard, you know, it's not like you guys trained stateside and then deployed together the way we do it today. You know, you join them in Vietnam, you hop on a truck headed north, and you're a member of Alpha Company 1-1. When did you first cross paths with Gunny Canley?
Well, he was a company gunny. You know, you cross paths with him the first day. Big guy, big man, 6'2", 6'3", and big eyes and just soft-spoken. I mean, he is unlike any Marine NCO officer that you will ever meet. He didn't curse. He didn't even say damn. He never cursed, and he never, ever raised his voice. But when he spoke, you know, he listened. So I saw this big gunny, and his rep was that of, you know, Audie Murphy. He was on a second tour of Vietnam.
Yeah, all right, so talk to us about the you guys hearing about where were you when you got orders to Hue? Were you still up at Con Tien? Had you gone back to Quang Tri? Where were you guys, and what were you doing when you got orders to go to Hue?
Well, we had been in the field for months, 4 months, because that transcended Con Tien in 67, then Quang Tri, I think Christmas. So we were in the bush, and on 30 January 1968, they said, you guys caught a break. You're going to an airbase called Fubai, and they have hot showers and actually hot, cold showers and hot beer. But they had beer, they had showers, and they had food. And they had these tents that had a wooden platform so you would sleep, you know, maybe 3 feet above the ground. So we were going basically to Disneyland, you know.
Right. Right.
Now the problem is they did helicopter. Our normal TO for a company is around 280, 300, but they only could take 147, 140 something because darkness fell. So we were, half of us was in Fubai, the other half was at Quang Tri waiting to get lifted the next day. Unfortunately, you know, at midnight it became 31 January 1968, which was the Vietnamese Lunar New Year called Tet. And although we had many, many indications there was going to be a major offensive, William Westmoreland ignored them, and 80,000 NBA came down from the north to the south all the way to Saigon and attacked South Vietnam.
All right, so you got half your company at Dubai, and what happens next?
Well, we got rocketed around in the middle of the night, but after Con Tien, 400 rounds, and we had they had these big bunkers by the hooches. It was like just an annoyance, you know what I mean? We were salty. We were in the bush.
Right.
And then around 4, our company commander, Gordon Baxter, told us to saddle up, and he said, you'll be back by noon. We're going to go help a CAP, a combined action platoon, a couple miles from here, no big thing. So we left our packs. I had one bandolier of ammo, and my socks were wet, so I put my combat boots on, without socks, and we mounted trucks in the dark, and we initially went south on Highway 1, which is right, Phubai was located on Highway 1, which is the main north-south road in Vietnam.
Right.
And then we stopped, the sun came up, we turned around and we're going back towards Phubai. And we're going to have another day off of, you know, they had movie tents, they had, you know, beer. It was great. So we passed Phubai. And 9 miles north of Phubai is Hue. So as we pass, again, there's about 147, if that many. We start getting sniper fire from the west flank, and we're dealing with that. And then as we get closer to the city, they have French homes, and we had never seen anything like this. It looks like New Orleans. It does not look anything like Vietnam because Hue was a French city, and basically all the architecture was French homes. So we're getting hit from the west flank, and we're returning fire. And then as we get closer to the city, the houses, we're in the suburbs, basically. So houses are not attached, but they're close. And they have yards and little stucco walls. Then we really get hit. And the Captain Batchelor ran out on a road to get a wounded Marine, and he got hit with 4 rounds from an AK-47. It severed his femur. And the corpsman didn't have their full bag of tricks, so they hit him up with an entrenching tool. And some tanks came. There were like 5 tanks. Somehow we met up with American tanks. And so now we have no more company commander. And the lieutenants were back at Quang Tri. So Gunnery Sergeant Canley takes command of Alpha Company, which is normally a captain's billet. And his executive officer, by default, was an E-5 sergeant named Al Gonzalez. So we have an E-7, an E-5, and the rest of us were E-4s, E-3s, E-2s, and we had some privates. So we were a junior enlisted group. As we are proceeding north, the distance between Phubai and Hue is 9 miles. We saw crap. We saw Arvin cut in half, tanks, bodies, just mangled all along Highway 1. And as we got closer to the city, the houses start firing. They had NBA snipers in the houses. And so we had to go clear houses. We literally had to clear houses, send 2-3 Marines in the house. And there was even some hand-to-hand combat just getting in the way.
And John, were those main force NVA soldiers or VC?
No, all NVA at this point. With two battalions, we found out later there were 2 battalions just on the road going in, and then another 8. It was basically, and I'll come back to this, but basically it was 147 of us. By the time we got to Hue, there was only about 60 or 70 of us that weren't killed or wounded. So we didn't know, because there was a lull in the fighting as we reached the city limits. And we had walking wounded. We had the dead on trucks just thrown in, you know, no body bags yet. Because we were getting fire the whole way. And we had wounded on tanks, and the tanks were getting hit. So that's another story. So when we got in the way, there were 10,000 NVA soldiers in the city of Hue, unbeknownst to us, you know. Found out that number many, many years later by Marine Corps historians. But at the time, we didn't know. You know, we don't know where we're at. I don't even know where I'm at. I don't know anything about a tent offensive. I don't know Hue. I don't know. I'm a PFC, you know, looking down my nose. So we fought a ferocious battle just getting in the way. We were the initial reaction force in the way, and they controlled the entire city except for the Citadel and a McAfee complex. That's the only real estate the NBA did control. When we got underway, we went to the McAfee.
All right, so you're headed to the McAfee compound in Sideways. So talk to us about one of the interesting things when you read about Sergeant Major Canley Inouye, and there's a really interesting piece of video done by your good friend General Ray Smith, who's a bit of a legend in the Marine Corps, but he's the second lieutenant who ultimately makes an appearance here later. But he says, you know, Canley's a fatalist. He said, he may not have described it this way at the time, but, he believed that if there was something with your name on it, he'd been around enough to know that, you weren't going to hear it, you weren't going to see it in time to duck, and that, that was the way it went. And he had no fear. I mean, he had made peace with that, and he went about his job. And the video of a guy like Ray Smith getting emotional, I mean, is powerful, powerful stuff when he talks about this man. So talk about, as you guys go through, and again, if anybody, if you've read anything about the Battle of Way City, John just skipped over some pretty formidable stuff about the way they fought to get to Way. And he mentioned that. But I mean, when you read about it, it's like, holy shit, that's just to get there. They're a depleted company when they start. So talk to John, talk about, and they lose their company commander right away. So.
Well, I'll back up to one instance at Contien. This is back in 67. When I say the NBA was close, they were very close. And there are about, a few hundred guys that fought with the Gunny at different points in 67, 68, and they all have the same general comment, is that he never ducked, he never ran, he never flinched, he just walked calmly. The instance I'm talking about, and this could be multiplied by 30 instances, different instances, is that we got hit, and we were in tank ruts, and a guy got hit over a little knoll. And he's screaming, Corman, Corman, Corman. And every time we went to get out, the NBA, the bullets were just all around us. Corman comes running up, he gets shot. Another guy comes running up, he gets shot. And they're all screaming, Corman, Corman, help, help, over this little knoll. And we would try to get up, and it was just impossible. And all of a sudden, Canley comes walking down the tank drill, not ducking, not running, walking down the tank trail, walks over the little knoll, picks up the first, the most seriously wounded, and he just walks back to a safe area, hands that guy off, and repeats that trip two additional times, never got hit. And 10 guys watched this and all, and everybody has the same thing. How come he doesn't get hit?
have you guys ever solved that question?
No, no one has. In fact, no one. It's a mystery. We all just wonder. I mean, if you read the book The Gunny, you'll read where at least 20 guys have a different story. Where he's just calmly walking into enemy fire, and he doesn't duck, he doesn't run, he doesn't. He never gets hit, so I don't know.
I call the God who governs the flight of metal through the air, that's a fickle son of a bitch, whoever that is, male or female, because, the experience is, you see people who should get killed who don't. You see people who have no business getting killed get killed. And then I think, everybody comes to the conclusion that, well, most people come to the conclusion that, not a whole lot I can do about this. You have examples like with the old breed, Sledge fights every day on Peleliu and Okinawa and never gets a Purple Heart. I mean.
Oh, yeah. Those guys.
And that's almost Canley-esque in terms of the amount of metal that must have flown by Eugene Sledge and never got him. And he said, Sledge is pretty funny. He says, my friends used to, you know, used to bust my balls. Sledgehammer, where were you all that time, man? The rest of us all getting whacked and you not getting a scratch. And he said, they used to give me the worst time. He said, I feel guilty about it. But it is one of the things of the randomness of combat, you know, that if you watch something and you see it, it's like that clearly cannot be happening again. Like, what does the guy have, a force field around him that deflects metal? How can this be? So it is one of the most amazing things that you see when you see that, but you don't see it very often because most people that do that, they do get nicked.
Yeah, we can't figure it out. we discuss it every time we get together. But what happened at Way 2, I'm shooting ahead forward, but is that when you were mentioning about a big battle, there were a bunch of awards, statements of valor. They all got lost. In fact, the gunny was initially written up for a Navy Cross, and that got lost, and then Ray Smith got him a Navy Cross 2 years later. But the entire packet was lost somewhere. But the guys, you know, I am in total awe of the Marines, my brothers from Alpha Company. And in the book, The Gunny, I try to document their valor. Although, you know, at least it will be documented somewhere, if not officially, then in this book.
My guest is a man who's led about what? How many different lives have you led, John? About three or four different lives. John Legato, from Philadelphia, now resides in Jacksonville, North Carolina. I met him 2 weeks ago at the Marine South Expo when Alex Hetherington took me over and said, you got to meet this guy. And John's been gracious enough to join us this morning. We're talking about the fight in Hue City and the book that he wrote. The book is entitled The Gunny, about Sergeant Major John Canley and the Marines of Alpha 1-1 in their incredible fight in and around Hue during the Tet Offensive of 1968. Talk to us about, so you get in there, and, you know, you describe, it's almost like he's a fictional character, right? A Marine gunnery sergeant, as big as he is, right? And he's still, I mean, he's a big man to this day. And yet he doesn't raise his voice and he doesn't cuss. What is that? Like, I didn't even know that existed, let alone in the circumstances that you're doing it under. Talk to us about, John, as the fight progresses. You guys continue to take casualties and talk about him as a leader. I mean, he's leading the Marine Corps hadn't even done, I mean, most people got, you know, a couple days of mount training, right, in some bullshit little mount town in Camp Pendleton or Lejeune. It was just rinky-dink stuff. And you guys are in one of the great fights of the Vietnam War and certainly one of the great fights that the Marine Corps has been in post-World War II. So what was that all like?
Well, it was, once we got in the city on that first day that Golf Company came in behind us, and we went to the river. The Pershing River separates North and South Way. It's all one city, but it's separated by this large river and a bridge, the Nguyen Khang Bridge. And across the river, they set us up at the river. And I looked across the river, and at the Citadel was a big NVA flag. They had, middle of the night, they took over the city, and we're flying their colors. And as I looked across the river, there was hundreds, it turned out to be two battalions, you know, of NVA just standing, you know, across the river. And my buddy Carangio said, you know, we weren't used to seeing, I can't say we saw them up close and personal, but not nonchalantly and not, you know, a few thousand of them.
I'm not.
We looked across the river and he says, there's got to be good guys, right? I said, I don't think so, Nick. But the problem was there was a South Vietnamese general named Truong, who was the top general for South Vietnam. And he was surrounded at the Citadel. He kept calling back to Phu Bai, which was our Task Force X-ray, which had control over us. And their intel was that there was only two undersized NVA battalions that weigh, as opposed to 10,000 NVA.
Whoops.
So they went to send Golf Company across the bridge. At the point of the bridge, they had machine guns. You know how narrow a bridge is, and when you're trying to get a company of guys through such a narrow passageway. Long story short, the Golf Company almost got decimated. They got across the bridge, and they lost so many men that they had to get the men back, and they lost a ton of men just getting back. They didn't take the Citadel because the Citadel was not, you know, it was reinforced by I don't know how many battalions of NVA. So now we have, at the MACV is a makeshift hospital. There's one Army doctor and about five corpsmen, and there's literally, 100 wounded in various stages of death. You know, guys were just dying waiting to see a corpsman on the cement floor of the MACV compound. It was a horrible sight. But and that was day one. So lasted 31 days. On the fourth day, we start running patrols, and we had a big battle the fourth day at the St. Joan of Arc School, where we were told to take this complex to the convent, a Catholic school, a rectory, and the NVA had, I think, three, four companies, reinforced companies in that building. And when we went in, we had three platoons in, undersized platoons, and we deployed in different areas. And the problem was they had classrooms, and we had to clear each room. And we had no training, right? You said there was some training. There was no training in Vietnam on urban combat, or room clearing or breaching. We had no training. But Marines adapt. And so we would clear a room, maybe the first time we just bust through it, and then one guy would say, no, I'll kick the door and you go left, I'll go right. So we basically were doing, I was on the FBI SWAT team. We were doing the correct way after one or two breaches of a room or something, or clearing of the room. We would actually figure out the right way to do it that I learned later on, which was amazing. But in the rooms, and some of the rooms were NVA, so we're in these classrooms, we're having gunfights in the size of a small classroom. And that was amazing. I mean, that's, you come in a room and, there's an NVA across the room, and, you're firing on automatic. So, but anyway, we're getting the crap kicked out of us in this school, and the gunny decides to go on a suicide mission. I mean, if you read his Medal of Honor citation, he gets a satchel full of grenades and C4, and he goes above, on a catwalk, to try to get above the enemy. Now they know he's going there. They can't see him, so they're just firing all these rounds up. And he got wounded, shrapnel. He kept going, got wounded some more, kept going until he got into a position, over the enemy, and he threw a satchel on him. He devastated a company, and they ran out of NBA, and, we took the school based on the gunny doing that. Had he not done that, we would have never taken that complex.
And so that fight goes on. How many days are you in there fighting?
31 days. I was hit on 21 February. It lasted until 2 March. But it was 31 continuous days in firefight after firefight. So basically, you were in 3, 4, 5 firefights a day. Let me give you an example. At night, we would go into a building and hold it. The NVA would be downstairs. There's in the book, the Marines talk about sticking their helmet out the hallway and having tracer rounds come down the hallway at them. There was hand to hand in different parts of the city with the Alpha Company Marines. We had barricades The second night, I could tell you this story. If you remember, I said that the XO by default was this E5 sergeant named Gonzalez, who eventually won the Medal of Honor on 4th February. And so we set up homes the first day protecting the MACV. We're in trench homes surrounding in front of the MACV. And all the windows are broken out. And about middle of the night, there's these noise, like screaming. And we can't figure out what's going on. But it's a bunch of hoots and hollers. And then we realize the NVA is across the street. And they're screaming, "You die, Marine. F you, Marine. You die, Marine." Now, it sounds pretty funny now, but believe me, they're across the street and screaming and hollering and hooting. So Sergeant Gonzalez is making the rounds, and you know everybody's puckered up because this happens in movies, but never happens to you, you know.
Right.
So he said, "Legato, you went to Vietnamese language school. Say something back to get them to stop. You know, say something." So I learned phrases like, you know, "Hi, how you doing?" I couldn't imagine me saying, you know, "Hi, Tron, across the street. My name is John. How are you guys doing?" And, you know, Tron say, "We're doing good, John. How are you over there?" You know, so. But everybody's waiting for me to say something. So I jump in the middle of the doorway and I scream, MFing Dukes at the top of my lungs. And everybody in our house, the Marines started laughing, and it sort of punctured the pressure, you know.
Did they shut up?
They basically shut up for a while, and they really did. They probably couldn't figure out, you know.
What was that? That's funny. John, talk about, you know, your good friend Ray Smith shows up as a second lieutenant to take over the company. Talk about that. And, you know, just watching General Smith talk about Sergeant Major Canley is pretty amazing. General Smith is one of the officers that I know in my career who has the how do I say this right? He had so much credibility because he had this. Not only was he smart, right? He's one of those guys who he speaks with that southern drawl, and he's as smart as a whip. And he's got a down to earth personality with a spine of steel inside of it. And so he's just one of those guys who has so much credibility, had a way with being a leader, and also with a way of being tough. That didn't alienate people. He's an incredible leader during my time in the Marine Corps. And it seemed like every time the Marine Corps was doing something, Ray Smith would be in the middle of it. Talk to us about him showing up and what happened when he showed up.
Well, yeah, he was back at Quang Tri. He was actually the officer in charge of the Hilo lift. And so he was, you know, dying to get in the action. But when Ray came to Vietnam, I had been there a few months, and you know, to get a second lieutenant, he was right out of the basic school. And it's like, oh, no, another second lieutenant. But Ray Smith came out of the basic school as Ray Smith. I mean, he came fully formed as a great leader. So he gets to Way, and there's no officers. But he had one day over the other two lieutenants or something. So they said, "You're the company commander." So he calls in the gunny. And he says, "Gunny, I want you to take 3rd Platoon as a platoon commander." And the gunny said, "Gonzalez got 3rd Platoon," and which was Alfredo Gonzalez. Now, we had been in Way like 3 days, 4 days before we got there. And going in, let me get back to, we were almost in the city proper, and we were getting automatic weapons from the west flank. To the east was an open rice paddy, and back on Highway 1, the NVA cut off any retreat back to Fubai. So we were proceeding north using a ditch to return fire to the western flank. All of a sudden, NVA machine guns open up due north. So now we're getting hit from the north and the west, and We couldn't go east because it was an open rice paddy, and we couldn't go south. So Gonzalez and Gunny Canley, they jump in the rice paddy. They have law rockets around their back. They had hand grenades, and they had their M16. And they're leaping over. We're giving support fire to the northern machine gun positions. We're trying to get them down. They're leaping over these mud swales, if you've seen a rice paddy. And bullets are hitting up all around them. And they're firing law rockets, and they'll jump over and fire. And they got within 20 yards of the NBA machine gun positions and threw hand grenades and eliminated. Otherwise, we would have been wiped out because we were in a crossfire. So Gonzalez, and then Gonzalez distinguished himself a few days later. So the gunny was going to write Gonzalez up for the Medal of Honor, which he did, in which Gonzalez got the Medal of Honor. So we had two Medal of Honor winners in 3 days out of 100, well, 70 guys by the time we got in, which is amazing for any Marine outfit.
Right.
So when Ray Smith comes, Gonzalez is a quiet guy. He's 21 years old. He was in second tour. And so he tells the gunny, you're taking third platoon. And Gunny says, Gonzalez got third platoon. Gunny didn't speak much. He didn't waste words. So Ray Smith says, Gunny, I know, but I just feel better. You're more experienced. You got third platoon. And Gunny said, Gonzalez got third platoon. And so Ray's like, maybe he didn't hear me. He said, no, I feel better. He said, listen, Lieutenant, Gonzalez got third platoon. If I should be with anybody, I should be with you. And when this is over, I'm writing him up for the big one, with the Medal of Honor. And Ray Smith loves to tell the story that his first official act as a company commander was an attempt to relieve a Medal of Honor winner.
Oh, man. You know what? A tough way to cut your teeth. But, you know, Ray Smith, could you tell even then that he was a leader?
Yeah. He was amazing. He and Ray Smith worshipped the gunny. I mean, Ray Smith has said in his 30 years in the Marine Corps, any decision he ever had to make, his first thought is, what would Gunny Canley do? I mean,
wow.
He took over the company and he only had 3 months in Vietnam or 2 months, so he was a new lieutenant, but. He was amazing, and I could tell you Ray Smith stories all day.
We're gonna have to do that because I mean he's if you were in the Marine Corps in the '80s and the '90s, you knew of really the legend of Ray Smith, and the only organization doing anything in the '80s was 8th Marines, and every time they seemed to do something, he seemed to be in the middle of it. And so everybody heard about him. And then if you were fortunate enough to hear him speak about leadership, you know, you really saw the personification. And then John and I were talking before we came on the air, but there was a group of those guys, Tony Zinni, Ray Smith, Marty Steele, and there's one more whose name
General Jones.
They ran together from the time they were lieutenants, and they were just these incredible down to earth leaders with a capital L, and were that way their entire Marine Corps career. And so you heard about General Smith. I mean, that's some big time leadership in a small organization. John, I want to ask you. So when do you decide that you're going to write this book? And is this a book about Gunny Canley? Is it a book about the company? I know it's entitled The Gunny, but talk to us about when did this kind of crystallize in your head that you needed to write this?
Well, and that's a great question. We didn't have social media. I was discharged in 69, and the Alpha Company Marines were all junior enlisted. I don't think any, there might have been one or two out of the original 147 that stayed in Marine Corps, but basically we all got out. And when we got out, there was no social media, and we didn't have a unit. You know, it's not like we all were in the armory around the corner.
Right.
So we did not communicate 20, 30 years And then guys started getting together, you know, one, two, three, and then more. So then we would meet, and when we would meet, we would talk about the gunny. I mean, like, did you see that? And you know, I'm an FBI agent at the time, and I'm listening to this, and you know, these are eyewitness statements. So I asked Ray Smith, and I said, what happened? He said, the gunny got the Navy Cross, and they even lost that. And, but there's three missing days in Marine Corps history. There are three missing days that no one knew but those, all those junior enlisted guys that were going scattered to the wing. So I'm thinking, and they all had a gunny story, but it wasn't the same story told 20 different ways. It was 20 different gunny stories. That way, one example is, you know, guy runs out, gets wounded. Two more run out, they get wounded. The gunny runs out and gets all three of them. And I mean, story after story after story like that. And I'm thinking, this guy should have got the Medal of Honor. So I start compiling statements, and it took 13 years. Everybody told me it had never happened. They won't upgrade a Navy Cross 50 years later. I'm at Lejeune, so I go golfing with all these retired officers, and they say, hey, we've tried stuff like that, and never happened. And it got rejected 10 times, never based on the merits of the heroism. It was procedural stuff. I'll give you one example, and this is my favorite example of the 10 times. I get a call from some Lieutenant J.G. in Navy, Department of the Navy, and he said, we're rejecting your packet. And I said, why? And he said, well, sir, my job is to make sure the packet's complete, and it's not. You have 11 missing signatures endorsing. You have all these people had to endorse that were on a chain of command. There were 13. So he said, 11 signatures are missing. So I said, no, they're not missing. So what it was is 1968. I had to get the commandant, assistant commandant, division, assistant division, regiment, equivalent. There was 13. Only two were alive, which was Ray Smith and Gordon Batchelor, the company commander.
Right.
And so I researched the heck out of it and had date of birth, date of death, and cause of death. I mean, I researched it that well. So I said, no, all the signatures were there. And he said, no, it's missing. And we just kept going around. And I finally said to him, and he kept saying, my job is to make sure the packet's complete, and it's not. And I said, you know they're dead. And he said, yes, sir, I know they're dead, but the packet's not complete. I can't forward it. And I had 10 of those sort of procedural things where it took me 6 months to find an adult to say, yeah, okay, they're dead. You don't need their signature.
You know, you people hear stuff like that, and you're like, aren't we supposed to find a way through those things? And then once we recognize those facts, and I don't know what change has happened in the DOD here in the last half dozen years. But it seems to me that somehow or other, somebody with half a brain has gotten involved in these issues, and you're finally starting to see, you know, the heroic action of men and women who fought for this country begin to be recognized in a more it certainly isn't timely, but at least in an accurate manner. So what ultimately gets this through, John?
Well, I gave up a couple of times. At Congress, people wouldn't call back. Nobody cared, you know. One congresswoman lost all the original statements, and I had to go get them back from guys all around the country, you know. And I love my Vietnam brothers, but, you know, you call and say, hey, Greg, you know that statement you did for the guy? What statement? Oh, the statement. Oh, yeah, I remember. Can you get it notarized? No, I didn't keep it. I mean, so basically, I would get angry because when everybody would say he didn't deserve it, before I started this, I took a year to research Medal of Honor. So I looked at hundreds of Medal of Honor winners. You know, I read their summary of action. I read their citation. I read anything I could. And I knew, and again, I'm a retired FBI agent. I knew that there was more than enough for him to get the Medal of Honor based on comparison of all the other ones I'm reading. I mean, it was, he could have gotten two Medal of Honors. He could have got easily two. So I knew he deserved one. And the naysayers and the, you know, the not returning phone calls and that idiot Blumenthal who claimed he was a Vietnam vet, he wouldn't return a call. And anyway, it was 13 years of frustration, and I would give up for a month, and then I'd get pissed, and then I'd start calling people and screaming on the phone.
And so what makes it go?
Well, finally, it got to awards and decorations, and I knew if it got to awards and decorations, it would get through. And we got feedback from people that were on the board, and they said this was a no-brainer. I mean, it went through in a couple minutes. They said it wasn't even debated much. It was like, yeah. But getting it there was, I went, 2 months ago, I went to awards and decorations, the unit at Quantico there. And they were laughing. You know, it's the first time I met them. I spoke with them, and they said, John, when this came in, the money was, you know, 100 to 1. This would never go anywhere. So I don't know what got it through. The guy got it through. I mean, it finally got to where somebody could judge his actions and not dead general signatures.
That's amazing. Where were you when you, how were you notified that it had gone through?
Well, I had, as an FBI agent, I had informants. I had, after 13 years, I had informants. And I can't get the names, but I got the unofficial word that it got through. And I still didn't believe it, you know.
Right.
And then what happened, I think the president called the gunny and said congratulations. So that was pretty much it then.
Wow. Talk to us. So in writing the book, I always find it very interesting when interviewing authors to talk about the whole process of writing the book, because even your experience in Way, right, somebody's a block away or a building away or a room away has a completely different experience, right, in the same vicinity. What did you learn in writing the book?
That's amazing. I interviewed, you know, 40 of the guys, 30 of the guys. And you're right, the perspective of, like, for example, there was a time where the gunny was making rounds the first day. I mean, we were shell-shocked at night. And I said, gunny, how does it look? And he said, don't look good. And he walked off because he didn't go into a long explanation. But that was like a death sentence, the gunny saying it don't look good. Well, that's what I thought. And then in writing the book, Larry Lewis, who was a PFC, was at the next window. And he overheard that. And then Larry tells his reaction to it don't look good, which was, he was from Tennessee, and he was looking for the Tennessee River if it connects with the Perfume River, because, you know, it was the same death sentence. That, and the firefights, too. The guys looking at firefights and battles and things that you went through from different perspectives of the same thing in it. It was wonderful, and talking about their emotions, they talked about that and what the gunny meant to them, and, you know. So it was a wonderful experience. It was a tribute to the Alpha Company Marines and the gunny as the leader, and the gunny is tied to every major battle at play, you know, through his Marines.
He's almost, you know, when you hear you guys talk about it, he almost seems like a mythical figure at times, right? The gunny, this big man that doesn't use profanity, that doesn't raise his voice in the midst of this cacophony of death, right? Moves about with impunity, just doing what needs to be done and never gets hit. It seems like something out of a novel. Was there anything that you learned about the battle that surprised you that you didn't know it, you know, having gone through it?
Oh yeah. I looked at the intelligence failure. It was horrible. Without getting real deep into it, the North Vietnamese general, Jeff, I think was his name.
Right.
Was all over Westmoreland. I mean, he threw Westmoreland a head fake. Westmoreland believed that the major offensive, and that's funny, Alpha Company, New Year's, right around New Year's, we captured a NVA officer, and he had packets of information. He had a satchel. And we forwarded the satchel up the chain of command, and it turns out, and I found out researching the book, that it had indications that the NVA were going to attack major population centers in South Vietnam soon. And Westmoreland was convinced they were going to attack Khe Sanh, which is up at, by the DMZ in Cambodia.
Right.
He puts all the resources up there. Like, for example, he takes a bunch out of Way and moves them up there. And so Giap, the NVA general, throws a bunch of mortars in like a month before Tet. And Westmoreland sends more troops up there, leaving virtually South Vietnam unattended, like Way City. They had hardly any military presence because Westmoreland threw them all up north. So the intel, and then the refusal of the Marines at Task Force X-Ray to believe their on-site commanders. For 5 days, they insisted they were 9 miles away, that there were only two NVA undersized companies, when there were 10,000, when you had Lieutenant Colonel Gravel, our battalion commander, saying, no, there's more. There's more than, you know, there's hundreds, if not thousands, and they refused to believe that for whatever reason. There was an Army warrant officer, Al DeMilo, I interviewed, and he was flying his helicopter on 30 January near Way, and he sees a battalion of NVA at Port Arms running down Highway 1. He thinks. So he goes low, and he, you know, because uniforms are hard between North and South.
Right.
So he radios in, he says, you know, permission to engage. I have a visual of NVA troops running down Highway 1. And it's negative. We have no intel of any large enemy troop movement that far south of the DMZ. You do not have permission. They're friendlies. So the Milo goes down to about 300-400 feet at the end of their formation. And he sees their NVA, and they start shooting, you know, at him. So now he radios back, and he says, I've confirmed that, you know, the formation is NVA, like the bad guys. You understand, the bad guys. Permission to engage. And they say, negative. We have no intelligence of any large formation of NVAs in that area. And DeMilo screams, I'm giving you the effing intelligence right now. And he opened up. I think he got the Distinguished Flying Cross. But, you know, that's the kind of stupidity that went on. Johnson was picking out military targets from the White House. It was just a screwed-up war.
My guest, very graciously today, is John Legato, talking about the book he's recently written about the Marines of Alpha Company 1-1. During the 1967-68 time frame, in particular, their leader, Gunnery Sergeant John Canley, the Marine Corps' most recent recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor. John, first of all, I want to thank you for being so gracious with your time this morning. I love talking about leaders in the Marine Corps. I love talking about the experience, also the experience of writing. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about the book, about your experience at Way, that without which this interview is not complete?
Well, where to get the book? I've written about 5 books, but the Gunny is the only one. It's limited. You can only get the Gunny at johnkenley.com. Johnkenley.com. And my other books, different fiction from the FBI, terrorism. I got a bunch of terrorism books, and I got a book coming out in a few months called The Comey Gang, about James Comey's group of Peter Strauss and those geniuses, that you can get on Amazon. If you just type my name on Amazon, John Ligato, L-I-G-A-T-O. But if you want the Gunny, johnkenley.com.
John Kenley. And you can only get it there?
Yeah, the Gunny, yeah, that's the only place you can get it, johnkenley.com.
All right. Well, you know what? That's good to know. Give us a little synopsis of your other literary works.
Well, I have 3 fiction books, all about, well, 2 of them are about counterterrorism. I taught counterterrorism at Campbell University, national security, for about 8 years. And so it's an FBI character doing terrorism, but except it's 75% true. It's supposed to be books of fiction, but they're not. And then the Gunny and Comey's book, and then my first book was called Lurz's Lies, about undercover agent going against the mafia. So that's 5 books, I think. I have 5 books out.
And you can find all of those if you type in your name under Amazon.
Yeah. I'm either John Ligato, Amazon, or Simon & Schuster, or Barnes & Noble. It's available through all those avenues.
John, I would love to. I do a thing called Battlefield Studies, where I get maps. And I would love, I'd love to sit down and talk to you about doing one of Alpha 11's, that lead elements movements up to Hue. And I know they get used a lot by Marines because the map's included and then the first-hand experience is about. But I hope you don't mind. I'm going to give you a call. I mean, the story that you tell, and I've heard, you know, when you hear the story of Hue City, the story centers around the 5th Marine Regiment. And you also hear about Alpha 11. Is that fair?
You know what? There's always been that who was in first. I mean, there's no disputing. Don't get me wrong. Gulf 2-5 took a tremendous amount of casualties,
right.
And so did the Citadel Marines. They took a bunch, I think 1-9. I can't remember the... But Alpha Company was the first company in the way, the first reaction force, and took the brunt going into the city. But then again, you know, who cares who was first? You know,
right.
We were. But yeah, that's the problem. I think you're referring to Mark Bowden's book. It was all about 2-5. But you know, it's whoever you talk to.
Got it. All right. Well, I will give you a call, and I would love to do that and with you or you and a couple of your peers, and because I know Marines love them. I get comments about them all the time. Whether you know, and again, I've had General Christmas on talking about his company in Hue, and that's why all these places that you're describing. Not only him, but another platoon commander that was in 1-5, Charlie 1-5, my old company, inside the Citadel when they got on LCUs and went up the river and then got off on the northwest corner and then came south into the city and ran into Phase Line Green and whatnot. So, I mean, on Google Maps, I've been to Hue City. I've seen the graphics of the attacks you all did, but the fighting you all did getting into the city, and then on the southern side of the city, and everything that you guys did is an unbelievable story. So I'd love to do that with you, but most of all today, I just want to thank you for coming on, and you've lived an interesting life, my friend, And congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for coming on and telling us about the Marines of Alpha 1-1, to include the Gunny, the Marine Corps' most recent Medal of Honor recipient, and that is Sergeant Major John Canley. So, John Legato, thank you very much. It was a pleasure meeting you 2 weeks ago in Camp Lejeune, and thanks for doing this today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Anything for Marines, really. Thank you, Mac.
All right, bud. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
There you have it. That is very graciously John Legato talking about his company, Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, and a little bit of history behind that company, and they wrote a whole bunch of it that day. So, unbelievable. Godfather of All Marine Radio just chimed in. The last 2 days of interviews have been unbelievable. No joke. Mike Etor yesterday, Josh Gilkey after Etor, and then John Legato. It's a pretty cool culture, I'm not going to lie to you. And I say that chiefly in my mind, my experiences with post-traumatic winning and the way that culture gives so freely of itself and cares about everybody and the way Marines want to help people, other Marines, and then their friends, family members, and people in their community. And you hear it, Mike Etor yesterday talking about he's going to be buried in a pair of Marine Corps utilities. So that's how I will be laid to rest. I'm a Marine. I care about this stuff. I love that. I might even copy it. Like, what else are you going to get buried in? Some bullshit suit? Come on. But no, thanks to Bob Nielsen. No, you know, our culture is just an amazing culture. And you see stories like this. You know, but the thing that's amazing, though, is the God who governs a flight of metal through the air. How did it miss Eugene Sledge on Peleliu and Okinawa? The whole fight. And then, you know, Legato says he never ran anywhere. He stood up and walked. He stood up and walked. And he never got hit. Well, he got wounded. You know, Ray Smith telling the story about, you know, pulling the piece of shrapnel out of his eyebrow. You can find the book at johncanley.com. Canley spelled C-A-N-L-E-Y, and John is spelled J-O-H-N. The Gunny by John Legato. How about Legato, man? He's got a fairly interesting life, too. You know what? And I walked up and got introduced to him, and he was as gracious and nice as you heard him on the radio. Just a wonderful guy. And started talking, and then started introducing me to other people standing around him. Hey, Mac, I want you to meet this guy. So, no, it was wonderful to meet him. But my thanks to him for doing this today. And he essentially said what he just... what he said. Here's a little blurb about the book. There are 3 missing days in Marine Corps history. What occurred on those 3 days has been lost until now. It involved one of the bloodiest battles in American history. Marines fought house to house and room to room for 30 continuous days, battling the NVA's best troops. On 31 January 1968, Congressional Medal of Honor recipient John Canley led 147 Mud Marines into Hue City, Vietnam. Awaiting them are 10,000 NVA regulars for 3 days, Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, battled these overwhelming odds, minus commissioned officers. They were outgunned and outmanned, but they had The Gunny. The Gunny is the definitive book written on the Battle of Fort Way City. It is the first book written by the Marines who were the initial reaction force into Hue during the 1968 Tet Offensive. The grunts who changed the course of history. The actions of Gunnery Sergeant at Hue City are a testament to American leadership and valor. Again, johncanley.com is the only place that you'll find the book. Again, my thanks to John Legato. Don't touch that dial, because coming up, you're going to hear the first hour, which is some of my comments about this discussion about discipline that is an important discussion in the Marine Corps. So don't touch that dial, and then we check some news. And then you'll hear some audio from Lieutenant Colonel, he retired as a Brigadier General, Ray Smith, and you'll hear that, as well as you'll hear a little bit of audio from Legato and a little bit of audio from John Canley. John Canley is a man of few words, literally a man of few words. So don't touch that dial. Have a great day. On a Tuesday, All Marine Radio, over and... Wait. All right, now it's ready. Out.